Welcome to the Aptivate podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Lobdell, and today I'm joined by Piotr Predkovich, a senior marketing analyst at Formel Skin. He's an expert in tracking, cleaning, and protecting mobile data, and he's here to show how smart data and smart privacy fuel real app growth. Let's dive right in. So Piotr, just to kick us off here, tell us what Formel Skin is and what you do there.
Hello, and thank you for having me here, first of all. Formel Skin is a company that started in 2019 here in Germany, and it's basically solving the problem of lack. It's not lack of doctors, but you need to, in Germany, you need to wait a month if you go to the dermatologist for the appointment. And we basically solve that problem by moving everything online and make it digital. So you're way, way faster to get the appointment. We have our own doctors that working for us. We have creating our own medicines, basically like formulas that we can apply to the customers. So the communication with the doctor is much, much faster. It's more and more personalized. And that's basically the most important stuff of that. So we had over 1 million treatments since we launched it in 2019. So fast growing and like a lot of happening around here. I'm personally working as a marketing analyst in the different companies since 2016. So I'm pretty much a vertical agnostic. I've worked with the dating app. I went outdoor adventures. I work with fintech and now in a health tech. So pretty much long, long time already, 9 years tracking the users and try to find out who they are, what they're doing, our stuff around it.
I feel like I need Formel Skin because here in California, it takes, at least where I live, like 3 months to see a dermatologist. I'm a surfer. So I always am worried about things on my face and also like rosacea and stuff like that. But it takes so long to see a doctor. So that's a great business there. And you mentioned you're kind of agnostic. You've had a lot of experience in the analytics space. How did you get started in mobile marketing data?
Oh, you just start as an analyst. And basically then you are getting curious about what people in marketing are doing. And you just get closer, closer. And at some point, yeah, there's a very fascinating technical world behind it. Like they are more close to the customers, and to basically do the proper marketing or the growth, you need a technical backbone for everything. And this is where I start asking questions, why is this that? Why is this like that? And turns out that in the end, I was the one delivering the answers.
You've been in this space for so long. Is there like one lesson you wish you knew earlier in your career that would have helped you out back maybe in the gaming or the dating or wherever you were prior?
Yes, the first and most important stuff, don't expect perfect data, especially in marketing where you're combining different data sources and everyone is having their own data. Like you look at the ad networks, they are having their own calculations and hidden AI models, basically black boxes. You have your own data. And there's in between sits all the basically user data protection, GDPR. So don't expect anything to be fine and just click, click, and you get the results, but you'll be fighting to get the data. I wish I knew it early because this was the biggest disappointment in the beginning.
Yeah, it seems like it, because in the pre-interview, you said your quote was, perfect data doesn't exist. And why is that so important for junior analysts to accept?
If you come directly from academia and all the stuff that you're learning is basically how to apply it to the perfect data sets. And you go and in the real life, what you find out, like, this is not matching. This doesn't make any sense. So you need to basically find out this, looking for the common sense. Does it make sense at all what I'm getting? And if you are going to deliver anyone, like anything to your stakeholders, whatever the data is, dashboards, you need to be also responsible for the numbers. If you are going to deliver something, you need to be responsible for the work that you're doing. And as an analyst, you are not only analyzing the data, you're also responsible for the data. You need to know where it's coming from, if it's faulty, how it's faulty, if it makes sense or not. So go in that direction.
So especially with all these like privacy changes and everything, I feel like there's two paths. One, it's kind of the easy way where if somebody already logged in, you have a lot of information about them, they've registered, and those are fairly easy to track. I know it's not perfect data, but it's easy to track. But it gets trickier when you don't have any registrations or signups. So how can you live with that? Like, how can we work with people, or how can you track users before they actually register or sign up?
Yeah, whenever they land on any page or an app before they sign up, you just need to find a way to assign pseudo user ID. So like find something that you can anchor to them. So usually if you do not know that much about user, because you don't have any behavioral data in the beginning, you try to anchor it to the device. So find out information about device that you have access to, of course, within all the data security and privacy setup, and anchor it to this entity and create one entity and then follow this entity. And some point, if the entity registers and you know, oh, it's a user, and we can get all the other stuff around it that helps you follow up with the business. You get the address so you can ship stuff to it. You get the first name so you can personalize the stuff around it. But until they sign up, you're basically chasing a little bit of ghosts around the stuff. And if they do not consent for any tracking, what you can do also is basically zoom out a little bit and don't focus on any single entity, but just get the aggregated data. So you cannot pinpoint it to any one user or potential user on your side, but you get groups of tens, hundreds that you can get some first insights from, get some behavioral data, what they're going to do and how they're interacting with your product or service. But it's very much not going to dip into the privacy. So you're still respecting that.
You're chasing these ghosts, you're zooming out. What are the pitfalls in doing that? I know it's not perfect, but yeah, what are the pitfalls of zooming out and chasing those ghosts, as you say?
If you zoom out too much and you basically just throw everyone in the, like all the eggs in the same basket, you will not be able to differentiate between them. So imagine if you are like trying to find out like who's your perfect audience is and you just look at all the users that are there, but you are mixing males, females, and others. Like you are mixing different age groups, different genders, all the different characteristics that people are having all together. So in the end, you may just end up having so generic product or service that you think is tailored to the average user. But in the end, the average user is just some of like individuals. And you will need to differentiate a little bit there. So it will be so bland in the end that people just not feel anywhere connected to it.
And so there's a ton of data coming in. You're trying to make sense of it all. Can you explain how you combine the front end behavior data with the back end events to really understand the user journey? Like what tools are you using there? How do you do that?
Right now we're using a lot of web tracking. This is where our main product is. So for the front end right now, we are using Google Analytics mostly. It's a very GDPR respecting manner. So we basically live with that. We are losing some data and we are not going to recover it. The biggest part is combining front-end data is basically having one part of tracking, but the back-end data is what you're having internally on your side. Shortly said, front-end is what users are doing on their side, what they are clicking, scrolling, and back-end is how you service react to it. You have constantly back and forth with the data between them, but in the end, they have different dimensions of the data. So what the backend has is more like connected to your internal setup, what you have in the company within the product, whereas front-end data is more connected to the device. So you have much more information, IP address, if the user agrees to actually share it with you, the country operating system version, app or a web version that you are having. Whilst on the backend, you are very much don't care that about that kind of stuff, and you don't gather it. So stitching those together, it's usually what you do when you have either the user register and you have the user ID generated by the backend and attached to it that you can basically send from backend to frontend. Or previously, if you try to make fingerprinting before the sign up, so we try to gather different information, mostly about the device, and generate some pseudo user ID out of it and attach it to user.
You kind of have this pull or this competition between device versus the user. What do you think causes the most noise or confusion when trying to stitch this data together?
The biggest confusion is, I think, in the way that the difference between how we people technically think about it and how the users think about it. So user thinks that I am a user, I am real person. Whereas from technical perspective, person without device does not make anything.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah, and device can as well exist without any user. And this is multi-to-multi connection. So it's not one-to-one. You can have one user, one person operating two different devices, switching from tablet to mobile to desktop. You can have one mobile phone with one app being shared between different users. So the biggest pitfalls is like combining those in a way that makes sense. So if you're going to bring me back to the original question, I will.
I think you nailed it. Like, what causes the most noise or confusion when trying to get this together? And I think you answered it by it could be multiple users on one device. It's very complicated.
Yeah. And you also can have the cases when the information about the device is changing over time. Also about the user. If you have set up the age of the user, of course, it changes every year with a birthday. But you can take your device and go on a vacation. And all of a sudden, you can think, why is my German user all of a sudden in Spain? Is it the same user that something changed? Did it teleport? So that stuff you need to also take into consideration.
Yeah, the location, definitely. You've been around for a long time. You've seen a lot of privacy changes, especially in Germany and just with iOS in general and all that. So I feel like it's always a balance between privacy and tracking. Where do you think most companies go wrong with balancing privacy and tracking?
I don't think that is a wrong approach, but most companies, it depends on the department. If you think about marketing people, they say, we need all the data because we want to send all the data to the ad networks to have the best signals so we can have like our marketing campaigns optimized as much as we can. So have the lower customer acquisition costs. So then, yeah, we can grow in a very profitable way, but in a way that makes sense and sustainable for the company. Whereas from a legal perspective, you said, okay, whatever we don't need, we do not touch it. Just to be safe from the Digital Service Act, GDPR, if you're in USA, CCPA, basically all the other versions of laws that are created in a way that financial impact can be huge on you. And then something in between, there's like C-level, try to steer the company and says, yeah, but we want to have both. So what, in the end, solutions can we find out that's satisfying both ends?
And you did mention a couple minutes ago, device fingerprinting. Can you tell us what that is and what's your take on it now that privacy rules are tightening?
Fingerprinting on itself is just gathering all the information about the device that you can get and try to create as much unique version for each device as you can. And yeah, so basically it really looks like a fingerprint. You hope that it will not change over the time. The point is right now in a privacy new era that we're having right now, we come to the solution that iOS is basically forbidding it. But on the other hand, they are not necessarily strictly following on their own ruling. So yeah, you shouldn't do it. But if you do, there's nothing basically happening to you. I think that's if you do it in an aggregated way. So, of course, you start with a very, very like data per one device. But if you look for all the analytics for the stuff, you just keep the aggregated data and you leave the data about one single device away. You are pretty good from the legal perspective to do it. You have enough data diversity. So you can find a different type of user and different type of devices there. And the other hand, like you get enough data so you can make sense of it. And it's not so bland. On the other hand, I know that people do not like to be called a fingerprint and being fingerprinted. And of course, you have a lot of PII data that you could use there. And if you remove it because of the compliance with any data protection laws, you will end up with something that's not necessarily unique. But honestly, at this point in my life, I just said, leave it with like. It's better not to be, it's better to be on the good side of the law when it comes in the end. And if we are going to lose some information for marketing, for our product development, let it be.
Yeah, it's definitely a gray area. And it's going to be interesting to see how all these rules are enforced or they evolve. Do you see the future of attribution going into more of like an aggregate way? Or do you think that we'll always be able to see like a one-to-one user?
No, we're definitely not going to be one-to-one, and we definitely not going to be able to pinpoint one single user, either in our internal attribution or like internal data, as well as in marketing campaigns. We should already forget about it. How I see it, and in the direction that we're going, just get completely aggregated data in a way that we just don't look about single user, we just look about everything and just see if we have uplifts or not. So basically going down a media mix modeling when just like on a very top level tells you, yeah, marketing on one channel X is working a little bit, on channel Y is running a little bit worse. But since we have this setup still that you have marketing managers that are focusing on one single network, they will, of course, want to have like their network internal data when making the decisions. So you can use the aggregated data for strategic decisions, like where to shift budgets from channel A to B, from country A to C, and so on. Whereas you need still more granular data, but within network to make a day-to-day business decision, like to shift the budgets from campaign A to B, or like change anything in the targeting. So it's a combination of both. But I think that we can still live very much on the very aggregated level, and we just need to embrace it. There's no coming back.
Yeah, I don't think we're going backwards, definitely. And it seems like you're on the forefront of trying to figure all this out. You also mentioned in your LinkedIn bio that you're fighting against marketing fraud. What's kind of the sneakiest pattern you've uncovered there when you're fighting against this fraud?
Back in the days, it was good old days when you had a really like device level data and logs for every single device. It was fantastic to work with it. Now it's a little bit harder when you have the aggregated data. But the case that we had, and I always love it, was the affiliate network that when looking at the data and if you don't look very specific, everything looks fine. Like the user was coming in, we had the retention, no revenue. Okay, that was looking very dodgy, but retention was there. And then we were looking at a very specific type, like day 0, day 1, day 3, day 7, day 14, day 30. Like this is like standard. And on those days, everything worked perfectly. And I, for one time, just like turned it off and said, like, look at on day to day retention. And it was like day 0, there was. Day 1, there was. Day 2, 0. Day 3, yes. Day 4, 0. Day 5, 0. Day 6, 0. Day 7, yes. So they basically know exactly what's the standard of metrics that you're looking at. It was sending the traffic exactly on those days. So that was one of the first discoveries. And then if I dug deeper into the data, I found like devices that didn't make any sense. You have like iOS, but the version of the iOS was actually what you would expect from Android. You had iPhone made by Huawei, which is completely doesn't make sense. You have IP was saying basically Saudi Arabia, but the country was saying Germany. It was nice there to catch that kind of stuff. Right now, you have the aggregated data, so it's much, much easier to basically sneak into it. If you're doing, it's not so obviously. So you're just getting like 5% more of fraud within what you're doing and 10% more. In the aggregated data that's coming in, you will not see it. And there's a lot of different shady versions where you can do it. You can say, try to steal someone else's installs, or try to send like, we just send a click signal and hoping that somewhere someone installs the app and it gets attributed to us. Or what every ad network is doing is basically capturing the organic traffic, which is user that would come anyway to your product or service, and try to capitalize and say, yeah, that was us. Yeah, we did it. Pay us.
Yeah, that was one of the best answers I've ever gotten on this podcast for marketing fraud. So there's some customers that we work with, like at Reemerge, we're very anti-fraud. A lot of our customers work with affiliates. They love, not all affiliates are bad, but there are those sneaky patterns that you've discovered. And if people just looked a little bit deeper on, like, they're amazing CPAs, but I'm like, they don't mean anything if they're using different devices that don't make sense or just driving no revenue, but it makes them look good. So I wish that everybody would look a little bit deeper in that.
The problem is the alignment of incentives. As a marketer, you have your own goals, which is gather like as much users by giving CPAs or give the budgets, giving the consent budget, take as much user as you can and bring them to the product. So if there's someone who comes to say, yeah, but like half of your traffic is basically fraud, how would you react to it? Like, sometimes it makes sense when they said, okay, if I close the eyes, then the fraud is not existing. Because if we remove it, then I am not meeting my goals. So there's the incentives from a publisher perspective, from marketeers. It also there to accept it. There's, of course, the incentives from fraudster to do it. It's monetization, of course. There are some incentives from even bigger ad networks, like you have Google, Facebook, day, if they let some of it slip under the radar, basically, they're also getting cut of it. For the MMPs to do the fraud protection, if they do some kind of job, it's okay. But if you go too hard on it and they remove too much traffic, then yeah, the numbers doesn't match and you wouldn't do basically work with that kind of people. So in the end, like every part of like every group of people in the industry being on different sides, they are incentivized to basically do the fraud or just accept it. That's very, very sad because it's hard for people like me to come in like with the pure data-based evidence that yeah, this is fraud, this is what you should do about it. But the question that comes from the heads of marketing or CMOs is, yeah, but how much does it cost me? It's like to basically perform the analysis, to get the additional data, to have an analyst going over the data. It's also generating costs. And the question is, who's going to be responsible? Who's going to budget it? So the marketing doesn't want to budget it. Something that's basically in the end says, yeah, but you're doing a bad job. It's not their job, but like in the numbers, it will look like it. So tech is not going to budget it or BI because it's not the core responsible for them. If you go against it, it's very, very hard in the current setup.
Yeah, it's really hard to get everybody aligned. And maybe you have to have a tough conversation and say, hey, maybe your CPA shouldn't be $2. Maybe it should be $2.75, but we're going to be actually getting real people who are buying your product or making a deposit or whatever the action is. So that is tough.
There are some stuff that you can do about it. Like you can have a really long onboarding process. Hardly you find any kind of fraud in fintech when you have basically going and you need to create a bank account. Like you need to go there, show your ID. So it's harder to fake that behavior than what you are having a normal product or like e-commerce site when you don't even have to register to basically perform the purchase. But yeah, if you like try to make it a little bit longer, the process, and a little bit more like inconvenient for the users, you will probably also filtering out those frauds that would to be like do it on a very easy stuff. And there's also bots that's come down. It's like automatically clicking around on just like basically bypassing everything that you're doing and just pretending that there are callbacks from your server, mimicking the backend events or like backend tracking and say, yeah, here's something happening. You need to watch for this also.
And you're uncovering these sneaky patterns, as you say, like that the fraudsters or the bots are doing, but how do you stay ahead of the fraudsters when they adapt so fast?
Oh, you just go around and learn and talk with other people that are smarter than you. And like there are still a few beacons of hope in the fraud fighting community, I would say. But they're very, very technical. So you need to be technical about it. If you go like from the no tech savvy position, you will hardly find anything because you need to know it at least to find out if you are being basically lied to. So you need to have a little bit of knowledge to find out how it is. Like it's not necessary enough for you to fight it, but if you are being cautious enough, if you like can see the red flags, this is already good. But without it, they can tell you everything and you will just take it.
If you could fix one thing about how we measure success in mobile marketing today, what would that be?
I would then make a success responsibility of everyone. So not like right now we have, oh, marketing is for getting users to the platform, then product is for monetizing users or retaining users. Just make everyone all together. So find out, okay, this is the goal, but we are going to make it happen. And then you will foster the collaboration between tech and non-tech people. And this will already spin up the knowledge sharing that will make them all more cautious about everything and also fraud at some point.
Yeah, I think it all goes back down to what you said earlier, just alignment of everybody. So I think we covered a lot. We covered the fraud, we covered privacy and challenges there, tracking and your background. Anything else you want to call out or mention before we jump into our rapid fire round?
I don't think so. I'm really, really happy that we have the chance to make people a little bit more smarter about those topics.
I love it. Okay, so you're based in Berlin. So I'm going to ask you 5 rapid fire questions here. You don't have to think about it a lot, just quick answers off the top of your head. What's your go-to snack when deep in data work?
We are Berlin, so of course it's a Döner. So it's German version of Turkish dish. So, born in Berlin.
Very good. Where is the best place to get some Turkish food in Berlin?
Actually, next to my house.
What neighborhood is that?
It's a Biesdorf. So, it's the eastern part of Berlin. This is where I go next. This U-Bahn station was underground line station, Elsterwerder Platz, when I have one.
I'm going to rewind this episode for next time I'm in Berlin. If you weren't in analytics, what job would you be doing instead?
I would be probably marketer, doing the marketing, but with more cautious data way in there.
Staying in the marketing field.
Yeah, staying in the marketing field, but like I'm split between analytics and marketing. That's why I'm marketing analyst. The best of both worlds. Best of both worlds and like negatives of none.
Yeah. What's the last app you downloaded for yourself?
For myself, Blinkist.
Blinkist. I've heard of Blinkist, but what is Blinkist? It's a reading app?
Yeah, so they basically distilling the non-fictional books to about 15, 20 minutes format. You get the audiobooks when you basically get the best out of it.
Is there any audiobooks that you would recommend everybody check out?
Definitely. The one I went through and like completely was the Bad Blood. It's an old story from a few years ago about the Theranos, the big startup in US that was supposed to be delivering like blood tests on a massive scale. Like from one drop of blood, you can find out everything about you. And there was scamming people and basically not delivering, but in a scale that was like unprecedented.
Yeah, that's a San Francisco legend by now. I need to check that book out. I'm reading The Wide, Wide Sea. It's about Captain James Cook discovering, or I mean, you could say in quotes, discovering, but going down into like the South Pacific and his final voyage over to Hawaii, where he was killed by the Hawaiians over there. I'm like halfway through and I can't stop reading it. I love it.
Did they actually, on which part in the book that they decide, okay, this is the rum named after you, Captain Cook?
I don't know. I haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah. For something else, what I can recommend you to read is everything from Stephen Hawking. Especially the short answer to the long question. Oh, The Brief History of Time. It's a fantastic book that I'm reading every time. Never, ever have someone explained all almost theoretical physics to me in a way that made sense from A to Z.
Okay. I read a book similar to that called The Elegant Universe. It's about string theory and try to combine the... Oh, it's been 10 years since I read it, but trying to combine Newtonian physics with the other type of physics. I'm not smart enough to really understand it, but it was really good. And you don't really need to be like a math guy to get into that book. Brian Greene, The Elegant Universe.
Yes, I would try it. Definitely.
Cool. Going back to the rapid fire, two more. Favorite way to clear your head after staring at data all day?
Just lay down and do nothing.
It's a good way. I like it. If you could instantly master any non-work skill, what would you pick?
Woodworking. I always have like, I wanted to do something, especially when my kids were younger, that I want to create my toys for them from wood, but never had the time, of course, when the kids are younger, and skills.
Not too late. Not too late.
And maybe grandkids coming, so yeah.
There you go. I actually have typed into ChatGPT before, like how to start getting into woodworking. I'm really interested in that too. And I took a wood shop class in high school and I loved it, but I never followed through with it.
Yeah, I also had it. Back in the days, there was like some polishing and it was like, I don't know how to call it, in the part when you can burn in stuff.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Kind of like soldering, but within the wood. I really loved it.
Oh, it's amazing. And it's just so cool, like for presents, just to give somebody like a cutting board or something like that. It's such a nice present if you get good at that to give to people.
Definitely.
Okay, final question here. We go into our travel segment that I love. If somebody has a weekend in Berlin, what are you telling them to do?
Visit the museums. So we have something, Museumsinsel, which is like island of museums. And basically Berlin has more museums than rainy days in a year. So like over 100 of them. So definitely you can drop in and like, you go and it's like, oh yeah, like what's it, like new art, like ancient art, museum of how the German police was spying on people in like Eastern Germany. They kept everything. So one little place, you go around and you can spend the whole day there.
And what's that place called? The Museum Island?
Yeah.
Great. I'm going to check that out.
Directly translated from German.
Okay, awesome. So Piotr, thank you so much for joining the Activate podcast. How can people, if they want to look more into Formel Skin or just answer or have you asked questions about fraud or anything, how do they look you up?
Oh, they can look me up at LinkedIn, definitely. On Twitter, or it's called X right now, I'm more privately there. So if you're like interested in my Polish comments about Polish basketball league, yeah, you can also meet me there. But in English and about work mostly at LinkedIn.
Amazing. What's the difference between the Polish basketball league and the NBA?
The quality. I think that the quality is in a way that how we actually approach the coaching. And I have a good example like how to compare it, because the son of my sister has now went to LA for high school. So he prepares for the NBA. That's his biggest goal. And he got grants here to study there and train basketball. And the biggest difference, like they have five coaches for five people. Whereas here in Poland, like mostly in the Eastern Europeans, they have like one coach for 20. So you don't have this focus on different aspects of the games. It's like more like general or during the army. And you definitely don't have this sense of belonging. The coaches, the college coach, like in high school coaches, like they are pretty much proud when they have a player that has gone to NBA. And the player comes back and he gives back to the community also. Whereas here in Poland, like you go there and the role of coach is to win as much games as possible.
Yeah.
So they don't care that much about development of the players on their future. It's like focusing very much on the here and now.
And who's your favorite Polish basketball player?
Right now, Jeremy Sochan.
Okay.
From San Antonio Spurs.
Oh, great. Yeah, I know. I think the only one I know is Gortat. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, big guy.
He was there, but like my approach to him is he has chosen a few times NBA over the national team. So I'm like a little bit sour about this one.
Yeah, you got to represent the national team. All right, Piotr. Well, amazing conversation. Really liked the ending there. Really fun guest. Thank you for joining. And if anybody wants to look him up, we'll have your name, Piotr, P-I-O-T-R, from Formel Skin in the show notes. So thanks again and have a great day.
Thank you. I hope people have learned something and got fun and new knowledge.
Yes. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking a break with us and listening to our weekly episode of Aptivate by Remerge. If you enjoyed what you heard, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes and tell your friends about the podcast. The more people you tell, the further we can spread these awesome mobile marketing insights. See you next week.